Hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Be seated. Morning. We're delighted to welcome you all to the courtroom and especially pleased to see this morning students from Lodi High School. Would they please stand? Good. You may be seated. The students are here with us with the Court with Class program, which is a state bar and Supreme Court sponsored program. It's won national awards, and so we're delighted to see you all here as part of it. The high school students across the state are invited to come here, and if they accept the invitation, then they're sent briefs, and they may have read the briefs as well as done other work related to the case we're about to hear. And then a justice, as part of this program, a justice of the court, meets with the students and anyone else would like to attend after our second case. And they will be joined by students from Newman High School and MATC Business Law at about 12:15. So I've introduced you to us. I'd like to introduce the court to you all. On my far right is an empty chair, and Justice Sykes ordinarily sits there. Seated next to the empty chair is Justice Patrick Crooks. To my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley, and to her left is Justice David Prosser. And Justice Prosser is the justice with whom you'll meet at noon. And seated next to Justice Prosser is Justice Patience Rogensack. That's the lineup for today. And with that, I'll call the first case for this morning, 02-1915, Tammy Calliper versus, is it Wild or Wildy? Wild Pontiac Cadillac, Inc., arguing on behalf of Tammy Calliper is Paul M. Erspammer. You have 15 minutes, according to my sheet. Jeffrey Meyer of the Litigation Director of Legal Action will argue for 10. Counsel?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Chief Justice, Justices. My name is Paul Erspammer. I represent the petitioner, Tammy Calliper, and good morning. The decision on review, the reported Court of Appeals decision, threatens the system created by the legislature for certain types of cases that the legislature has chosen to distinguish by including fee-shifting provisions. And the manifest intention of the legislature in doing that with certain selected types of claims is to allow legal representation where the cost of the representation might otherwise make remedies unenforceable. The decision on review we submit, frustrates that legislative intent. It sends a message to the private bar of Wisconsin that even if they handle a meritorious claim and work diligently to bring it to a swift conclusion, that their fees and expenses may not be paid. That is exactly the contrary of this court's message in Shands versus Castrovinci, which invited the private bar to act as private attorneys general in enforcing claims like landlord-tenant claims in that situation, where the costs of the litigation might swamp or might overwhelm a relatively modest claim, like a claim for an unpaid security deposit. An $800 security deposit obviously can't support much litigation. But the message here is exactly the contrary to this court's position in Shands.
Counsel, and I accept everything you have said, but I want to just ask, when one looks at this case and you have a $6,000, say an $8,000 case, and on one side there's $53,000 worth of attorney fees, and I won't get into the other side, does that sort of raise questions? When you talk about preserving the system, is the system that anything goes, that any litigation is acceptable, and there is no reasonable stopping point as far as litigation? I mean, it kind of raises your eyebrows when you look at $53,000 legal fees for a case that basically, with the exception of around maybe 1,000 or so, could have been tried in small claims court.
Your Honor, the question was, is there any limit? And yes, there are limits, Your Honor. And the limits come from first of all, the plaintiff's attorney not accepting a case unless it has merit. Then we expect the defense to make a reasonable assessment of the merits of the case early on, Your Honor, so that the costs don't become so substantial in the case. Remember that the first offer in the case was made after 2 years of litigation, circuit court litigation. The $6,600, which you mentioned, is the amount of the settlement, Your Honor. But it's also true that the defense declined to make any negotiation before suit when the costs would have been very minor. For example, the circuit judge originally on the case, Judge Malmstead, told us in November, on November 27th, 2000, he said he reviewed a document where he said it may be somebody at Wild Pontiac better take a look at this, because that document was a financing application that was produced by one of Wild's witnesses, a Sandy Anderson Payne, and it confirmed, Your Honor, it corroborated Ms. Kalapar's story that she had engaged in a trade-in transaction with Wild Pontiac. And what Judge Malmstead was, the point he was trying to make at that point is, gee, you know, there is a fee-shifting statute here. Maybe somebody at Wild better take a look at this. Sadly, that didn't happen, Your Honor. The case continued on through litigation, and it continued on with rather vigorous litigation by the defense.
Counselor, just to interrupt you 1 second, what was the date of that when that document was first produced that you're talking about?
The document was produced in a deposition, Justice Rogensack, on August, I believe it was August 9th of 2000,
okay.
And the witness was Sandy Anderson Payne.
Okay, thank you.
Just to respond further to your question, at that point my attorney's fees were about $2,000,
okay.
Your Honor.
Thank you very much.
Counsel? Consistent with the brief submitted by Legal Action of Wisconsin, which focuses on, starts out with this kind of approach. Look, we can be swamped by the facts here, and there's a dispute of facts. But to get mired down in the facts, it is averred, misses the point. The heart of the matter is the method that the circuit court used to determine that Kalapar was entitled to only $15,000, and the reasoning that the Court of Appeals employed. So I want to get to, you know, oftentimes we hear, you know, just the facts. I want to get to just the analysis.
Thank you.
And Justice Wilcox asked you a question that dealt with essentially a consideration of the amount involved and the results obtained. As I understand your argument, you are advancing the lodestar approach of analysis for attorney's fees. Is that correct?
I agree, Your Honor.
And isn't an element that the court considers under lodestar the amount involved and the result obtained?
Well, even under our existing standard, the answer is yes. But even under our existing standard, under Supreme Court Rule 20:1.5A4,
yes, does the same.
The amount involved and the result obtained. And
so you're not arguing that you cannot consider, if you will, proportionality.
I would not argue that. And as a matter of fact, what I would argue is that the exact language of the rule, the amount involved and the result obtained, in this case, the result obtained, Your Honor, was a make-whole remedy for Tammy Kalapar. It's an $8,600 car. She sold it for $2,000. She got $6,600 in settlement from Wild, a modest amount, yes, 2 years into the litigation. She was made whole, and that is the result obtained. She used that money in a separate negotiation to pay off the bank judgment that was taken against her. It's an excellent result, and that is the character of the result that's obtained. But in so doing, you asked me about process, Your Honor, and the process that this court has set up is the SCR 20:1.5, a little hard to roll off the tongue there, standards. The first standard there is the time and labor required, which the circuit judge expressly said he would not consider because he articulated his reasons on page 72 and 73. Of his decision, but essentially said these things go on and there's mediation and there's no wrongdoer, so I'm not going to consider how long it took to get to this result. After two mediations in this case, Let's go back to the to your question about process, Justice Bradley.
Yeah, my question was about analysis.
About analysis.
And what's wrong with the analysis of the Court of Appeals?
The analysis is wrong in five ways, Your Honor. First of all, the analysis here did not determine the hours that were necessarily expended to achieve this successful result for the plaintiff. Second, the decision on review erroneously considered the fees of the unsuccessful defendant. That is a complete departure from Wisconsin law. Third, the decision on review abdicated the decision-making to a former discovery referee who lacked foundation, who had been excused from service the year before after only 4 months, and who was never appointed to serve on the merits. Fourth, the court adopted a proportionality standard, as we just discussed, and looked only at the dollar amount rather than the character or the nature of the result that obtained. And finally, the decision on review incorrectly concluded that plaintiff overpled and overtried her case when all five of her causes of action had merit and survived for a summary judgment, although she voluntarily dismissed an issue involving the federal odometer statute. The state odometer statute survived her trial. And the decision was based upon general impressions of the discovery referee who came back to the case after a year of absence, subpoenaed by the defense. So those are the five issues that we feel, five areas in which the courts, the lower courts, erroneously exercise their discretion.
I'm wondering if that really should be the standard in this case. I think that it's generally the standards that are set forth, Lodestar and the 12 modifications are possible. But in this case, you've got a consumer protection bill, as I understand it. And the whole point of this is to allow somebody who has a relatively small claim, $6,000 is a lot of money, but in life it's relatively small, to allow them to go up against somebody who has maybe potentially hundreds of these claims. So $6,000 times 100, now we're really talking about a little money. But for each individual $6,000, it's quite small. And the point is that you're supposed to be an attorney general. And you're supposed to be representing all the 6,000s, in effect. So you're really not representing $6,000. You're representing, in my example, $600,000 or more. So when you talk to me about proportionality and recovery and result, the point of this is to not say to the lawyer, well, you've only got a $6,000 case here, your client isn't going to be willing to pay for $15,000, $20,000, $40,000 worth of attorney fees. What you have here is a $600,000 or $6 million claim, and you can keep going. And it seems to me that ought to be the essence here. And then you say, well, did you put in these hours and did you get the results?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And we wouldn't ask for the hours that we didn't legitimately expend on the case. Your point is well taken that how many Tammy Kalapars, she's an 18-year-old, are going to be able to take on the wild automotive groups of our world unless there's a clear indication that attorneys can take these cases and serve as private attorneys general. I still need to meet my burden of proof that the hours expended were reasonable. In this case, Your Honor, when you go through and you make a pre-suit demand and there's no offer, then you make statutory offers of settlement in the litigation and there's no response to them. You go through two mediations in July and November of 2001, and yet the first offer from the defense is in December 2001 after the mediations. Go through two mediations and no offer. Your Honor, when all these mechanisms fail, or when there's no response from the defense to all these classic settlement techniques that this court and our procedural rules give us, what choice does someone like Tammy Kalapart have to either pursue the claim and prepare for trial and prepare to deal with the summary judgment motions and the venue motions and the protective order motions that are all denied in this case? What choice does she have but to plow on and prepare for trial or abandon the claim altogether? So we get 2 years into the case. They make offer one. She grabs it. She grabs offer one the first time a dime is offered to her, and then she's told the fees are too high. I'll tell Justice Wilcox asked me what kind of controls we have. We have controls, Your Honor, and we've had controls here in this state since Duello, the Duello case versus Board of Regents, where the court said if the defense submits an offer of judgment, the defense makes a hard-nosed, reasonable look at the case and submits an offer of judgment, and the plaintiff doesn't take it, and the plaintiff accepts less, and it's a fee-shifting statute, guess what? The plaintiff doesn't get paid any fees after the offer of judgment. And that's from the Merrick versus Chesney U.S. Supreme Court case. So is there a control here? You bet there is. And it involves the defendant taking a good, honest, hard look at the merits of the case, because in this case, we had them on the paper. I mean, that's my way of looking at it. The paperwork demonstrated that she was promised a trade-in. She was promised a dealership vehicle and a trade-in, and when she got it home, she found out that it was this guy's personal car, enriching him, and it also enriched Wilde. Now, how you can claim you don't have
Mr. Hirschbaumer, let me interrupt you for just a minute, if I might. What's the difference, do you think, in result if we were to apply the Lodestar approach as against the Supreme Court rule approach? Do you think the bottom line is the same?
I think the bottom line can be the same, Justice Crooks, but I think what the Lodestar does is it gives you a kind of a presumptive figure. What the trial judge is supposed to do under Lodestar, as I understand it from the Hensley decision, which the U.S. Supreme Court adopted in 83, is we start with a presumptive figure, a reasonable number of hours times a reasonable hourly rate. Okay, and that's the presumptive figure, and then we can use factors to modify up or down. Now, if you look at the factors they articulate, they're almost exactly the same as this court's standards in SCR 20:1.5. I said.
So it's really the presumption that you like, and that's why you're pushing the Lodestar method. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. Yes, and the reason is it presents a structure that we lack right now in Wisconsin, because we end up with this "what's the case worth" kind of thing that we heard from former Judge Crivello, who served as the discovery referee and then came in and made this gut feeling kind of recommendation, the same kind of gut feeling recommendation that the Court of Appeals told us we shouldn't do in Crawford County versus Mosel. If you have that gut feeling reaction, well, gee, it's a $6,600 case, good grief, you know. It just doesn't feel good. It doesn't seem right. And you don't look at the underlying factors that it took 2 years to get us here, and 2 years in which the paper showed that there was a pretty serious fraud that took place in this case. So, and the paper was out there from fairly early on in the process. So what I'm suggesting is that the Lodestar does give us a structure. After that, there's an adjustment, but the adjustment factors are the same as this court already has. Now,
Counselor, was there ever any discussion, not discussion, was there ever any disagreement by the defendants that the car at issue here that your client bought was simply a defective vehicle that was misrepresented to her?
The only witness who testified to that was a woman named Jamie Robbins, as well as a plaintiff, and there mm-hmm. was no controversy, no countervailing testimony at all.
Okay, so it's a given that the car was misrepresented, so what was being fought over is whether there was involvement by the agency in the sale. Was that basically what all this was about?
What Wilde's brief tells us, the central issue was the authority for Mr. Thompson to act on behalf of Wilde, and they denied, as you recall in the answer, they denied that he was a manager, so we had to get his employment file and go through a discovery motion to get the employment file, where it said he was Pontiac new car sales manager. Then we found out in discovery that Mr. Braun, who is the used car manager, also signed off on the deal, taking in her car in the trade-in, which he then resold at a profit. So you have not just Mr. Thompson and his authority, and he possessed it, he was Pontiac new car sales manager, but also Mr. Braun, another manager involved, and the deal was profitable for Wilde. They made money, they admit that.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Now, Your Honor, the considering the costs of
your time is up. You will have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel.
Jeffrey Meyer, Litigation Director of Legal Action of Wisconsin, representing the Amicus Curiae Legal Action of Wisconsin.
Thank you. I want to try to answer four questions at once from Mr. Wilcox, Justice Wilcox, Justice Bradley, Justice Crooks, and Justice Abramson. I don't think we need to depart from the abuse of discretion standard, but I do believe that the Lodestar methodology satisfies the questions that are posed by Justice Wilcox and Justice Bradley on the question of proportionality. It is not, I think, a matter of the size of the claim that is considered in the Lodestar methodology. One of the factors, however, that is considered in the Lodestar methodology is how close did you get to a meaningful recovery? If it is a $500 case and you get $500, but it costs $50,000 to get there, that is an appropriate use, if the time is spent reasonably to obtain full relief, that is an appropriate use of the judicial system, because the legislature has told us that we want private enforcement. It's not the size of the claim, it is the comparison of the recovery to meaningful relief. I think it's not cited in the brief, but it illustrates the point. Chief Judge Posner of the Seventh Circuit discussed it in a case, Hyde versus Small, 5 years ago or so. It was a constitutional case where a gentleman was arrested without probable cause. He spent 3 or 4 hours in jail and sued, obtained a jury verdict of $500. It was a small case. Very, very significant attorney's fees, however, because it was contested vigorously. Trial court said $500 case, no fees, shouldn't be here, small claims. Judge Posner looks at it and says, no, it was tried as a small case, but it does involve an important issue. Small nicks on our constitutional rights matter and need to be addressed. And that's why we have fees, so even the small ones get addressed. A small consumer claim, $6,000, among my clients, $6,000 is not small. It's a year's worth of groceries. But Brenda Shan's claim, a few hundred dollars of a security deposit, was in fact small. But it is the law enforcement that the attorney's fees availability makes possible. Private law enforcement is possible even for a small claim, and that's a good thing. But in determining whether the fee is appropriate, one then looks to see, is the result that you got reasonably consistent with what you could have hoped for? And if so, the Lodestar method says this ought to be a fully compensating attorney fee award because you have done exactly what the legislature has told us we wanted to have done. You've enforced the law.
Mr. Meyer, even under the Lodestar approach, don't you look at one of the factors being the amount at issue? Isn't that an appropriate thing to look at?
And the way the federal courts have developed it is exactly how I described it. It's not whether it's a $500 claim initially. It's whether you obtained $500 on a $500 claim.
So the focus is on the result?
The result obtained, yes. It's not, in that sense, a comparison of the result of what you could have gotten. Okay, let's use the word proportionality in that sense. But it's not proportionality of the amount at stake to the ultimate time and energy that was necessary to obtain it. If the hours were spent reasonably to obtain that result, the fee award should be fully compensatory. And that's what I think is the core problem with the circuit court's analysis and the Court of Appeals ratification of that analysis. It is that there is no connection at all between an implicit finding that time was unnecessarily spent and the huge reduction from the $51,000, the $38,000 reduction from 15 down to, from 51 down to 15. That's compounded because the trial court lumps all of the costs in there. Now, had the trial court explicitly said the $3,600 that was spent for mediation and for the discovery master, that was unnecessary, everyone would reverse that as a clearly erroneous finding of fact and an erroneous exercise of discretion. And if the trial court had said all of the expenses on defendant's discovery was unnecessary, that would be reversed as clearly erroneous and an erroneous exercise of discretion. The same thing with the plaintiff's discovery. Ever since Jerome Foods, we have to get out there and discover these cases. There's no connection, then, between what is ultimately the trial court's determination that $5,000 or so are appropriate in attorney's fees and the time that was actually necessary. The lodestar methodology focuses the court's attention. There can still be discretionary findings, and there is still plenty of room for a finding of fact at the trial court level. But the lodestar methodology focuses the trial court's analysis to say, what was the time necessary?
Well, let's say in this case that the settlement was for $5,000 instead of $6,600. Would that in some way then justify a reduction in the fee because the results were not as good as hoped for?
It might have justified some reduction. Yes. I mean, not a lot, it seems to me, because in all litigation, we have to be prepared to take less than a full loaf. But had it been a $1 settlement and it was accepted, then the courts are pretty clear to say that's so insignificant that you really got nothing.
I don't.
But that's where discretion can be used within the lodestar methodology. It's perfectly appropriate for that to be done. And that gets to the Merrick versus Chesney issue that was referred to. There is a powerful mechanism by which defendants can limit their exposure. They make a statutory settlement offer. And that freezes their exposure for liability if the ultimate recovery is less. But even that tool, and it is a very powerful tool in the hands of defendants, requires a very logical, focused method by which we can determine what were the fees that had accrued at the time of the settlement offer.
Seems to me, counsel, that when you say use the lodestar method and that you multiply, quote, the reasonable hours times a reasonable fee, you still get into the lodestar as what it were the reasonable hours. And so you still kick in there. Is it reasonable to spend, how many hours did you spend? Oh, I'm sorry, not you. How many hours is the...
It had been several hundred.
Several hundred. By what fee?
280, okay. Counsel advises me.
All right. So you have several hundred hours on a $6,000 fee. Somebody's going to say that is not reasonable. The lawyer should have just paid over the $6,000, which I had been tempted to do a number of times when I was a lawyer, pay off the client and get rid of it. It would cost me more than $6,000, right?
Yes.
So why spend all that time?
Are you asking from the plaintiff's perspective?
From the plaintiff's perspective,
Once the plaintiff has agreed to take the case, there's very little control on how vigorous the defense is going to be. Motion to change venue, a motion for summary judgment, discovery that was necessary, successful motion to compel that was necessary, opposition to a protective order to exclude a witness that was successful. Plaintiff's lawyers can look at a case and analyze the merits at the front end and say it's 50% chance or it's an 80% chance. But they can't look at it and say I'm going to get a bare-knuckle defense or I'm going to have a lawyer who's going to make me a good settlement offer out of the box. That plaintiff's lawyer can't predict.
I think go ahead.
I have another question. I don't see why it was reasonable on a $6,000 fee for a trial court to appoint to say go to mediation. And why appoint a master that's going to that totaled up almost $4,000. That's two-thirds of the court would have been better off paying off the plaintiff. I mean, everybody would have been better off paying off the plaintiff. The defendants would have been better off. The court would have been better off. I would have been better off.
Well, counsel, you had, and I want to just follow up on that. You had both a master and mediation here?
Yes. Yeah. Discovery referee. Yeah.
That's what the chief
is. What is a discovery referee?
A judge decides that a ex-judge should handle these disputes by the lawyers who are not able to resolve their discovery disputes without the aid of the court. just referred the matter to ex-Judge Crivello.
Is that customary?
I wouldn't say it's customary, but it certainly isn't unheard of. It's not extraordinary, and frankly, the lawyers don't have a whole lot of choice on this. They don't have a whole lot of choice when mediation is ordered. And it's out of the plaintiff's lawyer's pocket. Second, it's ordered. It's an expense for the plaintiff's lawyer, and there's no way around it.
Chief, I wonder if, counsel, if you would respond to the Chief Justice's last comment, and then I have a question for you.
On the whether the public the public is better served by having paid off the claim on its own, I think
if
so.
If there's a complaint about $15,000 of lawyer's fees, and the lawyer has to do all this stuff ahead of time, and that's viewed as reasonable, how is it reasonable, was my question, to have roughly $4,000 in court-imposed costs instead of the judge just deciding the case?
I'm not able to answer that. I mean, looking in the macro sense, there is absolutely no reason that the public use of the funds to resolve this dispute makes sense in a macroeconomic sense. It does make sense that we are using public funds to enforce an important consumer law around an allegedly abusive practice. That is a good use of the judicial system's resources. I can't really address whether it is a good use. This is for you as supervising forum, a good use for circuit court judges to be ordering mediation in such small cases and ordering discovery referees in such small cases. I can't answer that one.
Now, my question is this. If you folks prevail, what are the ramifications beyond situations where you have a consumer and an automobile dealership? What is the ripple effect in other areas of law?
I think it tells the defense bar to do a hard evaluation early. Do a very, very serious merits assessment early on. And there's no question that the availability of statutory attorney's fees ups the stakes for defense. And that's one of the purposes of it. It is to be a deterrent so that the underlying practice is abandoned willfully.
I think you're missing the import of my question. Wild Pontiac, I'm not from Milwaukee or that area, but everybody who has ever listened to Milwaukee radio knows Wild Pontiac.
It's a
big outfit. But doesn't the rule also apply to small used car dealerships?
Yes.
Small dealerships in Lodi. And,
yes.
I mean, it isn't as though it's little person versus big dealership. The rule is going to apply not only, I think, in automobile cases, but
and I can give you an example. Our organization receives money under the federal Title III Older Americans Act, and we sometimes represent landlords. We represented the plaintiff, represented the tenant in Shands. But we sometimes represent landlords who have duplexes who mess up on the security deposit rule. And we have to advise defendants, very limited means defendants. But it's our responsibility as advising defendants is to say, maybe you do have a claim here, but you messed up on the rule. Make a settlement offer now. Make it now and get this over with, because it is much better for you to offer $500 than to be facing a $15,000 or $30,000 attorney fee bill if we fight this for you. So I think guiding the trial courts, guiding plaintiff's bar and defense bar by saying we will use the Lodestar. The Lodestar is a methodology that is required, helps defendants counsel. Because they can say we have a predictable method by which if we lose, you will be socked. And we can't leave this as a coin toss at the end where we can try to talk the judge down from, you know, a fully compensatory attorney fee. I think adopting the Lodestar helps defense bar.
Chief Counsel, Justice Brantley.
Thank you. I'm concerned because I hear in your Lodestar argument that it's almost not just a presumption, but a per se correctness. Let me explain, and then if you could say, tell me if I'm right or wrong. I hear you say you do the reasonable hours times the reasonable rate, and if you get essentially the result you want, I hear you say, per se, that's reasonable. And I understood previously that Lodestar started with the reasonable hours times reasonable rate equals presumption, which can be then modified based on the elements set forth. There's a difference. There's a big difference. And what are you arguing?
Well,
per se?
I wouldn't say it's per se, but it's almost, but you're overstepping the important assumption. To get to the presumed figure, you have made the findings of fact necessary that these hours were reasonably expended. The hours are reasonably expended. The rate is a reasonable rate. Okay. Given those two assumptions, I'm pretty close to saying it's per se. Okay? If it's a reasonable rate and it's a reasonable work amount of work done, then yes, the Lodestar ought to be pretty darn close to per se. We can adjust it a little bit. Okay? We can adjust it if you sued for $1 million and you got $200,000. Okay? But if you have a $6,000 claim, if you've got full relief, then I think it is pretty close to per se. We've excluded the hours unreasonably spent. They don't count. That's why I think.
And that takes a experienced person, judge or other, to look at those bills and see what's. I'm old enough to have said when the public defender system first, when Niblick, and I'm talking about when the judges used to have to look at what defense lawyers did. And one of the reasons for all the questions here is that, well, what is reasonable? Because if, you know, certainly a defendant's rights are very, very important. But if you have a lawyer that, and I'm thinking of a case that sits, goes to have 47 conferences in jail with his client and then pleads him out, and he has a bill, and this is back in the 70s,
right,
of a bill of $7,000, and you say, oh, my goodness, and maybe perhaps that's what Judge Crivello did, but what you're saying is that the methodology was incorrect.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And with the methodology, you as a trial court judge in that situation would have said, you didn't need all these confrontations. Those hours weren't reasonably spent. They're out.
But judges used to do that in the public defense, where we each, when they were appointed, we would look at the bill and we used, as one of my colleagues said, the JC rule, which I won't go into, but you look at the bill and it's, my goodness, and you have to, there has to be something reasonable.
And the Lodestar method permits that, because the focus, that it focuses you to determine the hours reasonably expended. Absolutely.
Under the circumstances, but not necessarily just because you have a $6,000 case.
Not the size of the claim, that's correct.
Necessarily. That's okay. Correct. Thank you, counsel. Ms. Gutenkunst, we've got you representing Wild Pontiac Cadillac. You've got 20 minutes, and then Mr. Furlow, who filed an amicus curiae brief for Fairfield Resorts, has 10.
May it please the Court, my name is Catherine Sawyer Gutenkunst. It's a pleasure to be here this morning. I had obviously prepared my remarks, but I'd like to address some of the factual statements that were made this morning and caution the Court that there is a dispute relative to the facts in this case. The record in this case is replete with documentation that will, without a doubt, tell you what happened when. And briefly, I want you to note that the summons and complaint that the demand letter was sent to my client in 1995. It wasn't our car. We didn't sell it. We wrote a letter back saying it exactly that. We didn't hear again from Ms. Kalapar until March of 2000, some 5 years later, the day before the statute of limitations ran. We then have a motion for change of venue because the transaction happened in Waukesha, the parties were in Waukesha, the lawyers were in Waukesha, and the demand letter said we're going to sue you in Waukesha. We then, in February of 01, file a motion for a protective order because the plaintiff is seeking to receive my client's financial statements from 1994 through 1999. Every protective order I asked for was granted. I only asked for two, and they were both granted. In my objection to the financials, I said I would suggest as an alternative that they be filed in Cameron, which is a normal routine thing trial lawyers do when they feel something is sensitive and should not be put out in the open. That was in February. It wasn't until we got in front of Judge Curvello in May that the plaintiff's counsel acknowledged that that was an alternative. I had to file a motion, I had to file a brief, and I had to go to a hearing.
Counsel, what's the standard of review in this type of a case?
The standard of review, Your Honor, is abuse of discretion. And it's our position that Judge Cooper did exactly what he was supposed to do.
And the erroneous exercise of discretion, generally and should accept the exercise of discretion of the circuit court unless the circuit court misapplied the facts or misapplied the law.
I would agree.
As I understand, at least the argument from counsel of legal action is it is that the court misapplied the law.
I'm sorry, I have a cold. I didn't hear you.
That the argument is from legal action of Wisconsin that the court misapplied the law, that it, as a matter of law, conducted an incorrect analysis as opposed to made any findings of fact. So could you address whether or not the Court of Appeals or the trial court misapplied the law here?
I'd be happy to, Your Honor. It's our position that they did not. This court has stated that SCR 20:1.5 is a guide. It is not the end-all, be-all. It is not a checklist. Judge Cooper undertook 2 days of evidentiary hearings. He allowed the plaintiff to put forth whatever information they chose relative to how their fees were reasonable. He also heard the opinions of former Judge Curvello, who did not play a small role. He had hours upon hours of hearings and motions with counsel. Through all that, he saw briefs and submissions of parties. He understood that Judge Malmstead had said earlier that a party could be awarded costs for discovery in the event that the court determines that there was an abuse at a later date. He looked at the totality of this case, the 12 depositions, 2 counsels at depositions, the fact that depo notices are sent at 11:33 a.m. on a Friday for a 3 p.m. deposition on the same day.
Hey, counsel,
and he came to a conclusion based on that, Your Honor.
Can you point to me in the transcript of the judge where he considered those facts in arriving at his opinion?
Yes, Your Honor. If you look at the transcript, and I apologize, let me get my page out, at record document 128, transcript pages 94, 103 to 106, and 121 to 1.
Slow down.
I'm sorry. Page 94, yep. Page 103 to 106. And 121 to 125, the court took evidence relative to the prongs of 20:1.5.
And the record was 106?
It's record document 128, Your Honor.
28, sorry.
The in the appendix of your opposing counsel, there is appendix number 9. And that is the, as I view it, the opinion of the judge on this issue. Do you have that before you?
I do have appendix 9. Is that the summary judgment motion you're referring to?
The court starts out, it's part of the two-day hearing. All right, when I happen to be a judge that imposed $18,000 in attorney's fees, it is his decision, as I understand it, with regard to the imposition of the fees and or costs here. Page 73 of that transcript, he awards the $15,000.
I have it now. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Looking to where he starts on page 71 of what's been marked as, I guess, Exhibit 6, and in the appendix, number 9, is that the decision of the court that you're referring to?
I am, Your Honor. Record document 129, starting at page 71, as you've noted. And the court made those conclusions after the two-day hearing, after all the submissions of the counsel, and after argument of counsel.
And so this is what we should look to in terms of whether or not the court erroneously exercises discretion?
I think in part, Your Honor, but I think it would be inaccurate to not look at the totality of the entire evidentiary hearing. I don't know that, I don't believe at least, that this court is asking trial courts to make a mechanical decision based on every factor of SCR. In reviewing the cases, it appears to me that you are asking the trial court, who sits in the shoes of the individual who hears all, sees all. They have the opportunity to hear the way we conduct ourselves, the way we file motions, the way we handle ourselves in court. They aren't a cold transcript.
Now, I don't know if anyone's advancing. I'm not necessarily advancing that someone has to go through everything of SCR 20.1.5. In fact, as I read these pages you've referred to, 71 to 74, there's no reference to 20.1.5, but, you know, that's, life goes on. What I'm concerned about is what's the basis of the trial court's opinion, you know, that indeed exercise of discretion was accomplished and that it was accomplished on legally appropriate foundation. So that's what I'm looking for.
I think what the trial court relied on, Your Honor, was in particular certain items. For example, Special Master Curvelo, again at Record Document 128, pages 35, 64, 65, and 66, said the plaintiff repeatedly at several hearings before him went on and on about a request for production of documents despite the fact that he'd already ruled on it. It was a waste of time.
Let me try this. It isn't clear to me in looking at pages 71 through 74 and the pages you referred to regarding the Discovery Master Curvelo's testimony. As I understood Curvelo's testimony, he came up with a figure of $15,000 in attorney's fees. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Now, as I understand the judge's findings, or the judge's opinion, he said he agreed with Curvelo and that $15,000 was appropriate. Is that correct?
That's my understanding as well.
Then towards the end of that transcript, it turns into $15,000 attorney's fees and costs. Is that correct?
That is true.
Okay, so how much did the judge award for attorney's fees?
Your Honor, he awarded a cumulative amount for both. Bear in mind that a bill of costs was never submitted in this case, and bear in mind that the invoices of counsel were never admitted because they were filed with us the day before the hearing. So the court did not have the ability to review those itemizations, nor did defense counsel.
And oftentimes, I don't know in this case, I mean, sometimes costs are taxed afterwards, and I assume
right.
That's, I looked in the appendix and you have a taxation of costs by the, there's some kind of a, the clerk signing something for costs.
I believe she signed an order, but there were no additional costs taxed at that time.
Okay. So it isn't clear to me, if this is the decision of the court, pages 71 to 74, what was the amount that he awarded for attorney's fees?
Your Honor, he awarded $15,000 and in essence awarded no costs. And bear in mind that the statute that we're talking about in this particular case is a discretionary statute. This is not a Lemon Law case where it says shall. This is a may.
Well,
Judge Cooper didn't have to give him anything.
I know, but in order to discern if he's properly exercised his discretion in awarding attorney's fees, I have to know what
the attorney's fees are. And he based it on 15,000, took the figure from Crivello, 15,000 for fees, but on page 74, that turns out to be fees and costs. Question. As to cost, the court. Fees and costs, 15,000. Well, the offer was 15,000 plus costs. I think it wasn't, Your Honor? The offer's expired. Okay. 15,000. So it was 15,000 he awarded for fees and costs. And my question is, how much did he award for costs? Let me try it the other way.
I don't know, Your Honor, because that was all, what you have is what we have.
Yeah.
There were never taxable costs submitted.
And then you had, the judge signed an order for judgment, is that correct?
Correct.
And that was 15,000 for fees and costs, is that correct?
Well, actually, Your Honor, the judgment submitted by the plaintiff was inaccurate. It said $15,000 in fees with no costs, and the Court of Appeals pointed out that that was not an accurate statement and ordered that that order be amended to reflect the true finding of the court.
And it was?
$15,000 inclusive of costs.
So plaintiff got $15,000 in total.
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right.
But I think you need to bear in mind that when the judge made that determination, he was aware of the fact through an offer of settlement plaintiff had filed with the court, which is not normally the standard that we follow, that the plaintiff had offered to settle their claim on November 28, 2001, for $25,000 of attorney's fees.
I get back to, and I'm looking at the order for judgment, and I'm sorry, I just need to know how the court, how much he determined for fees and costs. The order for judgment, signed on June 6, 2002 by Judge Cooper, says $15,000, which sum represents attorney's fees and costs.
Correct, which was his order from the bench.
Yeah, and then it was reduced to a written order signed by him on June 6th.
Correct.
That's right. So I get back to my question. How much, if $15,000 represents attorney's fees and costs as signed by the order for judgment by Judge Cooper on June 6th, how much is attorney's fees? How much is costs?
I would say, Your Honor, that they're lumped together by Judge Cooper at that juncture in the hearing. The reality is he awarded $15,000 in fees. And I think if everyone had just sat quietly and moved on.
So he didn't award any cost reimbursement for the court-mandated mediation or the court-mandated dividing the fee for the discovery referee. That wasn't ordered.
He ordered that as part and parcel of the $15,000, and he also ordered that our request for fees on all the various discovery motions was denied because, as he noted, the flip side of that, I believe was his phrase, was that we get stuck with our own fees despite our previous request for fees.
Okay, so you've said that the mediation and the discovery master's costs were included in the $15,000. Is that right?
That's my understanding.
And on what? Did he order it, or just those two costs are included in the $15,000?
He never enumerated any costs because no bill of costs was ever filed. That was never before the court. So he didn't have an opportunity to itemize what costs would or would not have been granted because that was never filed and never presented.
Okay, I'm going to try a different way. How many hours did the judge say were reasonable, and what was the reasonable rate?
The judge did not comment on the hours or the rate, Your Honor, because the invoices of counsel were never submitted into evidence because they were untimely.
Counselor, was there ever any testimony presented by the plaintiff's attorneys that $280 an hour is a reasonable rate for a consumer action?
There was testimony presented by Mr. Erspammer, plaintiff's counsel, Your Honor, which is in the record relative to his experience. And I'm referring to Record Document 128. He testified to his experience, his professional relationship, the time limits imposed, and the customary charge for attorneys.
But it was just plaintiff's counsel. There was no ancillary testimony by any other lawyer?
There was not. There was an affidavit that was pro-offered by the plaintiff, but it was not accepted again because it was filed Friday and the hearing was Monday.
Okay. Thank you.
So at least there was testimony that ranged somewhere from, I think, 195 or thereabouts, 195, 198 to over 200 per hour.
Your Honor, I have to apologize. I don't know the exact amount, but I can tell you that the customary charge is found on 128, document 128.
Okay.
And page 121.
It's in the appendix.
Counselor, I have from one of the appendixes their
attorney's fees exhibit that goes about 4 pages. Was that never part of the record, or how do I have that then?
Your Honor, that came in a motion to reconsider filed in June.
Okay. All right.
And, again, we never had an opportunity to review it, to examine it. The court never addressed it. It was merely filed with the court as part of the motion.
Okay. Thank you
and
very much.
And did the trial court look at it then?
I don't believe he did, Your Honor. As I recall the hearing before Judge Cooper, he asked what the new evidence was as a basis for motion for reconsideration. He found that there was none, and he denied the motion.
Did anyone ask for a continuance when the court struck the evidence that was attempted to be presented?
It was suggested by plaintiff, Your Honor, that that would be an alternative for the defendants. But you have to understand in this case that Judge Cooper had previously entered default against co-defendant Randall Thompson. And quite frankly, Your Honor, the timeliness of the filing, as Judge Crivello and Judge Cooper noted, was ongoing throughout this case. And we didn't feel that it was appropriate to give the plaintiff yet another kick at the cat. And as Judge Cooper noted in the motion for reconsideration, when the adjournment item came up, he said, I didn't have a hope that you would get your act together, because motions were filed at 5 o'clock on Friday on a regular basis.
Now, your client had a defense, namely, you had an employee who was off on a frolic of his own, not part of your establishment, and you didn't think you should pay for it, right?
Your Honor,
in essence, that was your defense.
In essence, and Mr. Thompson's deposition testimony was compelling. He was credible. He said it was my car. She knew it. We were friends.
And the trial judge said, quote, on page 73, I don't see any gross wrongdoer here. And then on page 74 of the appendix, he said, and there's nobody here with clean hands. So neither of you are gross, but neither of you are clean, if I understand this this decision.
I've been called worse, Judge, so I'll take that.
How can we say that this is a valid exercise of discretion when the judge had no attorney fees, according to your statement, in front of him, no statement of hours, reasonable or not, oral statements by Mr. Crivello, which, unless I'm wrong, didn't state the number of hours or the rate when he, Crivello, reached the $15,000. Seems to me the judge has nothing to base reasonable attorney fees at all. The judge can either do zero. And is that your position?
Your Honor, bearing in mind that the burden is on the party seeking fees, the court can only award fees on the information that is presented. It is not up to the court, it is not up to defense counsel to put in plaintiff's case any more than it is during a trial. Plaintiff presented the information they chose to present. They did not get their fee invoices in a timely fashion. The court ruled on that. But
didn't he testified and this information still came in?
Right. And you have to bear in mind, Justice Braley, that the court said, I agree with you. You spend every minute that you say you did, but it wasn't reasonable. Judge Posner said it best in the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals case, where he said, in a $1,000 case, it is absurd to order a 1,000 hours of fees. You know, when this case came up for oral argument, my comment to myself and to my associate was, isn't the true standard here as to reasonable fees, what would a paying client call reasonable?
No, that is not the standard here, I suggest.
Well, Your Honor,
because the whole point of this consumer litigation is to give a person with a small amount of money a shot at getting recovery. Otherwise, you cannot represent somebody in a $6,000 claim, because the fees are going to come up to at least half of that, and there's uncertainty. So the issue for the client is, do you pay, spend $9,000 and risk zero, or you take your lumps at $6,000 and go home?
right?
Justice, I agree with you. That's the purpose behind the statute. But can we take that purpose to give plaintiff's counsels a blank check? At what point do we draw the line in the sand, Your Honor?
Well, one of the things to look at is, and I gather there was no gross wrongdoing on any person's part, as to how hard you fought. You, too, defense counsel, have a $6,000 claim and have to advise your client that you might expend $3,000 in fees and they're going to be out $3,000, but maybe they're better off being out $6,000 and getting rid of it, or that they cannot ever start paying these claims because once people find out that they're going to pay claims, they're going to be in for my 600 claims, 600,000. That's the advice you'd give your client.
And, Judge, I agree with you. One has to, as a defense counsel, evaluate a claim and decide the value of it as well as the strengths and weaknesses.
But the value here is not $6,000 to your client.
The value is what's it going to cost to defend. That's the value of the claim, as well as what are they perhaps going to have to pay if we lose.
The value is whether your client's going to get a reputation for paying off nuisance claims.
Well, that's true, too. But bear in mind, Judge, we didn't have an itemization of damages from the plaintiff until June of 2001. It was very difficult to understand the value of the claim when the original demand was for $39,000 because it had a federal odometer claim in it for treble damages, that we were successful getting that kicked at summary judgment. So it was difficult to understand the value of the claim because we didn't know. I mean, the itemization of damages, if you look in the record, it kept changing. It was a moving target. But you're absolutely right, Judge. I've represented Wild my entire career. And I will tell you that this is the first time I've ever been here with them. And I assume it will be the last. But you're right. Businesses, every time they get a demand letter, shouldn't be forced to write a check. That's not what the statute is about. It's about reasonableness. And that's where I brought up my own client, Your Honor. Is it reasonable in a case for my own client who's going to pay me with their $6,000 to take 12 depositions? My clients would say absolutely not. But that's a decision that Judge Cooper had to make, and he's the one who sat and heard, saw, and watched. He was your eyes and your ears. And if you tell the judge today, all trial judges, that we're going to substitute our judgment for that of your own, you take away their ability to resolve these cases. This young lady still doesn't have her money. It's sitting at the clerk of court's office in Milwaukee County. We're now 2 years out. We have now had our third litigation on this issue in here today. And if you remand, we will have our fourth.
Counselor, what was the rule that was violated by filing the bill of costs on Friday for a Monday hearing? Is it a local rule?
Actually, no, he did not file a bill of costs. He filed his itemized statement. It was a local rule.
I'm sorry. That's what I was looking at. The attorney's fee,
right,
which has, I believe, costs in here as I look at it.
It does, but I believe it's local rule 365, Your Honor.
Thank you.
But I would tell you, Your Honor, that the information that we were submitted and the information that went to the court
were
not consistent. And that was part of the problem. The bills that we received added up to $30,000, and that's in the record. And the bills that the court received added up to $40,000-some. So that, again, presented another problem for Judge Cooper because it wasn't there.
Okay. The bills that you received, this is when you two were talking about it before the hearing?
Oh, no. These were bills that were faxed to my office late Thursday afternoon and then by U.S. Mail Friday.
Okay, so they went to your office, but they're not the same as the one that I have out of the appendix, which I think is 4 pages long, and it ends up at $52,703.09.
That is a bill, Your Honor, that was submitted at the motion for reconsideration, and I do believe that the one I have relative to that appendix document is the same.
Okay, so there's an earlier one that I can find in the record.
It was not in the record because Judge Cooper would not allow it to be filed.
So there's no place for me to look at that then.
I believe that's a true statement, Judge.
Okay. So local rule 365 is what was violated by not submitting these in a timely fashion.
That's correct, Your Honor. And
okay,
as Judge Cooper said, the reason we have a local rule is because exactly what happened. What I got and what Mr. Tinsky, co-defense counsel, got was not the same as what Judge Cooper got.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Justice Prosser.
This case is not simply about a dispute between Wild Pontiac and the plaintiff. What will be the rule? What will be the effect if you win this case? What's the rule of law that's going to come out if you win this case, and what are the ramifications in consumer actions and vice versa if they win?
Your Honor, first of all, I don't look at it as me winning. I look at the trial court's decision being sustained, affirmed, because this isn't about me. I think what we're going to have, the law is exactly what this court has already said it is. SCR 20:1.5 is a guide. And all counsel, whether it be plaintiff and or defense, have to incur fees reasonably. You don't get a blank check. And I think what you're going to tell parties is that the trial judge, because they're our eyes and ears, they're the ones that are going to make those decisions for us, unless it is just so ridiculous, because they're the ones that sat and heard everything. I think if you remand this case and you say, go back and start over again, I think you tell every party who has a fee-shifting case, keep trying them, because there are fees incurred for being here, there are fees incurred at remand, and then we have a new trial judge who knows nothing about this case, who knows nothing about the parties, who starts afresh. So now, instead of a two-day hearing, who knows what we're going to have? And I think you encourage litigation, Your Honor, if that's what this court decides to do. And I don't think that's what fee-shifting had in mind. I think Justice Abramson hit it on the nose. She said it's so the little guy can bring a claim and get their rights upheld. And I agree with that. But you can't do it at any cost, Your Honor. And that's what I think Judge Cooper said here. There wasn't focus. There was overtrial. There were things done that shouldn't have been done. There was no need to do all of those things. And Judge Cooper is the one who heard and saw. And I would just ask this Court to affirm that judgment and the judgment of the two judges from the Court of Appeals who agreed with Judge Cooper, that he did, in fact, employ the standard this Court has set. He employed it, he attached it to the facts, and he came to a rational decision. And when you look at the offers of settlement, the ultimate decision is in keeping with what the plaintiff felt was reasonable.
Counselor, I have one final question. Who set the hearing for the motion on fees?
That hearing was previously set, Your Honor, as a trial by the court. Okay. And a default motion against Mr. Thompson was heard, I want to say, in February, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. And the court said, now the default's against Mr. Thompson and that the plaintiff has resolved her underlying claim, we will hear the fees in May.
Okay, so he said that in February?
I believe it is February, Your Honor.
Okay, and then the hearing was in May?
That's correct.
And everybody knew the date in February?
Oh, yes, Your Honor. It was May 13th and 14th. That was a date set prior to that default.
All right. Thanks a lot.
You read, I'm sure, Judge Fine's dissent.
I did, Your Honor.
Judge Fine says that he agrees with Crivello that the case grew barnacles. It did because Wilde and Thompson threw obstacles in Calipar's path that would make James Bond and his nails and oil disgorging Aston Martin green with envy. Good writing.
That's Judge Fine.
Okay. And then he lists a whole bunch of examples, all set forth here. Do you agree with any of those?
Your Honor, I will tell you, when I picked up this decision out of the mail and I read that dissent, that it hit me at my core. I grew up with a father that was a lawyer. I've worked for judges, and I have never, and we did not, employ Rambo tactics here. Judge Voss would come out of his grave and kick me if he thought I had done that. We did not, Your Honor. There's one letter, Judge, that I keep going back to, where I say to counsel, as an extension of the olive branch, I will clear my calendar to get your client's deposition. I sent him the name of the gentleman who truly is the manager, not the one that Mr. Thompson felt it was, because he was mistaken. I filed motions for protective order and put forth an idea of just hold it in camera. All of those ideas are pushed aside, and yet we proceed with hearing after hearing. We didn't take 12 depositions. We took 3. We didn't send out 34 requests for admissions on the day that discovery was closed. We didn't do that, Your Honor. And the thing that was most disturbing to me was that the dissent did not cite to the record, and that the dissent included references to mediation, which are clearly inappropriate under the statute. Suffice it to say, my spin on the mediation is not the same as plaintiff's spin on mediation. We came out with different ideas. But that doesn't matter, because it never should have come into the record. It's not appropriate. And that's why I started my comments with, when you look at a finding of fact in this case, please take a moment and go back to the record and see if you can substantiate that statement in the record. Because I think you will find that there are a lot of findings. The summary judgment is a perfect example of that, where in the appellate briefs and in the Supreme Court briefs, there is statement after statement that the summary judgment motion was denied. That just is not true. It wasn't true. And what really concerned me was the transcript of that motion hearing when appended to the appendix in this brief did not include the last two pages. And if you look at the last two pages of that summary judgment motion, you're going to see that there is a colloquy between plaintiff's counsel and Judge Malmstead relative to the federal odometer claim, where Malmstead says, now you're waiving that, right? And he basically says, well, I don't really know. I'm relying on defense counsel. That concerns me. And I think this Court needs to look long and hard at the record. And I think you need to give deference to the three judges who have done this before you, that being Judge Cooper and the two Court of Appeals judges. And I can tell you, Judge Abramson, that that dissent will haunt me a long time. And it just isn't true.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Furlow.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. John Furlow for a non-party Fairfield Resorts. As to Judge Fine, with all due respect, two judges on the panel did not reach the same conclusion as Judge Fine.
I always like the dissents, counsel.
The dissents tend to be colorful and interesting, and I was, and I like them too, but I think only when I lose. But the fact is, you know, the fact that there's a dissent here and this disagreement only highlights the issue, which is you have trial judges who we have vested with enormous discretion. Not unlimited, but enormous. And we cannot be in a position where we send cases back, create yet another round of litigation on attorney's fees, because then the tail's wagging the dog. And that's not right.
Counsel, as a threshold matter, do you have a case or cases pending on a fee-shifting statute? Is that why you're here?
I do indeed, Your Honor. I have a case pending in the 4th District presently.
And so are you here then advocating on behalf of whom?
I am here. I've been asked by Fairfield, who is my client, who has cases not only in the Court of Appeals, but has cases in the Circuit Court arising under consumer statutes that raise these questions. And they have asked me to present here what their position is with respect to what the law should be, because there's another perspective here.
And their litigation in their other fee shifting cases?
Indeed. And we set that up.
Are you here as a friend of, generally, friend of the court is, you know, a neutral friend of the court. It means you're not friend of anyone else but the court. I just want to make sure you're my friend here.
Well, Your Honor, I can assure you, Judge, I'm your friend.
You are friendly towards Fairfield, too.
I am as well, but to point out, let's be fair about this. Are there really any friends of the court? I mean, can we really say that...
I'm sorry you said that, counsel.
Well, I don't mean to be disrespectful. What I'm saying is, when people come, they have a position, and that's undeniable.
They usually don't have pending litigation, though, with the
That is a fair point, but I don't know what pending litigation the Legal Action Clinic has, but I don't mean to get bogged down in providing a disrespect. My point, though, is back to this particular case, that you have a situation, and I want to identify the standard, because there's been discussion about what the standard ought to be, and I've heard that there is a presumption in the lodestar calculation, and that's not what Hensley says. That's not what Hensley says. Hensley tells us at, and I can give you 461 U.S. 433, that once you calculate hours times the reasonable hourly rate, the calculation provides, and I'll quote, an objective basis on which to make an initial estimate of the value of the lawyer's services. That's the starting point. Now, Judge Cooper, as I understand the record, took testimony on those factors, and I probably would have been an elegant decision to list all those out and have reasons, but he didn't. because there were other factors in that case that were vitally important, and they are factors that I think, again, from Fairfield's perspective, and it's a defense perspective, undeniably, we see all the time. There are two sides to every piece of litigation, and I can't sit here and say who's right and who's wrong below. I wasn't there. That's why we have the trial judges to make those decisions and weigh those things out. But there are, and that's the kind of situation we're in here. We can't sit and start second-guessing because we don't know. We simply don't know really what happened.
Mr. Furlow, do you think that the factors that are set forth in our Supreme Court rule are sufficient to make a determination in a case of this nature?
I think, Your Honor, they are a sufficient starting point. They are may factors, which say if other factors come into play, those ought to be considered. And that's consistent with, again, what Hensley would direct, which is a trial judge is given two options, really. You can look at the hours in the timesheets and start redacting time, or you can simply make an equitable judgment based on what happened in the case, which appears to be what happened with Judge Cooper here. And you know, I think it's fairly clear he was quite concerned about how the litigation was conducted.
Well, do you think we should adopt the lodestar approach?
The lodestar approach, Your Honor, I think is a fair approach to adopt. I think it's the right approach. I would suggest as a practical matter, it is the approach that has been adopted in many circuit courts, in circuit court opinions. I don't think the result changes. It simply seems a codification, and Hensley, I think, provides some useful guidance along with its future cases as to how that ought to be applied.
But, Counselor, based on this record, how could the trial court apply lodestar?
Well, Your Honor, the trial court could because the question is whether the trial court takes evidence on the factors. And there's
looking at the hearing that went down, and I guess I'm concerned about how could the trial court apply lodestar.
Well, let me back up and perhaps.
And how could you determine the number of hours were reasonable if you didn't have a bill in front of you that told you how many hours were spent and what each hour was spent on?
The actual bills weren't in. However, the court was quite clear that there was no dispute, and he took on face value that the hours were there and the time was put in. There was no question that he knew what the number was. He knew
what is the number?
53,000.
No, I mean hours.
Oh, Your Honor, I don't know the hours.
Okay.
I don't have that information. But the judge took at face value the value of the time. That is, in effect, the same thing that the lodestar tells you to do. That's your initial estimate.
No, what the lodestar says is you must determine if the hours spent are reasonable. You cannot do that unless you know what was going on in the case and what the hours were spent on. You can't say, oh, yeah, for this case it's been going on 2 years, so I think 200 hours are reasonable. Maybe they are, and maybe they're not. But that's not how lodestar is applied, at least in my experience in the federal courts.
The evidence taken over 2 days consisted of testimony on various factors, including you had Judge Crivello, who had the opportunity to find out what was going on during discovery disputes. That's where most of your problems occur in litigation. So those factors, you know, with all due respect, were taken into account. Now, he did not make a mathematical calculation. You're absolutely correct. But lodestar does not require that. Lodestar is designed to provide factors to allow the judge to issue some discretion, use some equity to come to a fair result, because trial judges, I mean, they preside over jury trials all the time, they preside over bench trials all the time.
I know, but you know, I happen to have written an opinion on the Fourth District Court of Appeals where the trial court took no evidence on the amount of hourly rate that was offered by plaintiff's attorney and gave a much lower rate, and the court unanimously reversed it, and that opinion stands. Why? Because there wasn't anything on the record to make a decision on, and it has to be a factual basis. So I have real concerns about what this record looks like and how we're to decide what in the world to do with it.
Well, I guess all I can say to that, Your Honor, is this, is the evidence taken over 2 days that the judge heard, and that's in the transcript. Upon review of that, is there sufficient evidence based upon whether it's SCR 20:1.5 or the lodestar, which is functionally equivalent? Is that sufficient to sustain his discretion? And I would submit it is, with the additional consideration that the judge took into account how the matter was conducted. And that is a vital consideration.
I agree with you. I think that's a factor. I just
I have problems when we look at arguments for and against Lodestar and trying to figure out what we do with it with this record.
And one of the difficulties we have with Lodestar is every case seems to be a little different in how it's presented and what's critical and what's not. And oftentimes you'll see in Lodestar cases that you'll have factors listed and there's simply no information one way or the other on a particular factor. It simply has no bearing on it. So Lodestar really, I mean, to the extent that the idea is Lodestar gives you some precision, that's really not accurate because it doesn't. It simply provides criteria that are part of the mix.
Well, it gives you some basis in an evidentiary hearing, if you're the defense, for attacking the plaintiff's bill and saying particular items on the bill are not reasonable and why, and too much time was spent. It lets the plaintiff say, oh, yes, they were reasonable, and they were reasonable because of what I had to do because of what you were raising as defenses. So I just think it's a tough factual record.
The factual record is not the best factual record you're ever going to see.
Yeah.
Okay? However, the question really is, and this is really the standard, I think, on abuse of discretion, was there some logical rationale based upon the law and based upon the facts? And if you read the decision and you look at the Court of Appeals decision, you know, did they apply the law? Sure. The factors evidence was in. Was there a logical rationale? Sure. The court was unhappy with how the case proceeded. And that is something we ought to encourage our judges to do. My
Bradley.
Time is up.
Not yet.
Ah.
Justice Bradley.
She says ominously.
Counsel, you very correctly state the erroneous exercise of discretion and standard in terms of you have to look to see if the record upholds the judge's determination. What was the judge's termination with regard to attorney's fees?
So far as I can tell, Your Honor, the judge decided that there would be $15,000 in fees total.
The judge, in the judge's exercise of discretion then, did the judge deny costs for the court-ordered mediation and court-ordered master of discovery fees?
Well, there are two issues related to that. One is, I think the short answer is he didn't decide, but I think the reason is there was no bill of cost. But that's a factual record of the matter, I think, you know, counsel handled. But I think what I'm telling you is I don't think the judge exercised discretion one way or the other as to cost because the evidence was not before him properly.
So your view of the record is a bit different from counsel who just argued. You think that that the amount of attorney's fees was $15,000, or maybe it's not different, but that's what you think. Attorney's fees are $15,000, and when he said $15,000 fees and costs.
My view of the record, Your Honor, is that $15,000 was awarded in fees. And that was $15,000 was awarded in fees.
Attorney's fees.
And that there was no cost information put in by the party with whom had the burden. And you know, that was the judgment of the court. Again, I think going back
Would you concede that it's a bit unclear because at the end of his transcript he specifically says and costs and the order for judgment which he signs says and costs?
I think, Your Honor, there is some unclarity. I agree with you. I mean, that's undeniable. But we're faced with a situation, again, where you've got a trial judge with a fairly daunting task and tried very hard to do a fair job to reach a reasonable conclusion based on what he saw
Thank
in this
you.
Case.
Will the rule of law that comes out of this case apply to other fee-shifting statutes?
Absolutely, Judge, and I think it's a good rule. And the rule ought to be that it is fair, it is equitable, and it is right for trial judges to take into account the conduct of the litigation in how the fees are assessed. Because what we want to encourage lawyers to exercise good judgment, to be efficient, and to try their cases in a fashion that reaches a conclusion on a timely basis without unnecessary work. That's a critical rule, and it's one that it's not going to drive lawyers away from the practice, Judge. That's going to get lawyers involved in the practice and make sure that the lawyers here who are doing our work have guidance as to how that work will be evaluated
if we have a fee-shifting situation.
If I understand your position, it doesn't matter whether it's Lodestar or SCR, that you wind up in the same place because you put the same issues in.
Those two standards, Your Honor, I believe are functionally equivalent.
So you're not really fighting for a change in the law, keeping the rule because they're the same. Your position is the trial court exercises its discretion properly.
That is correct, Your Honor. And to point out that under the Lodestar, as articulated by Hensley, there simply is no presumption. We're dealing with an estimate that then gets adjusted.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you for the opportunity, Judge.
Mr. Erspammer, you've got 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Counselor, before you get started, I have one question I have to ask you. Was your submission of the bill of attorney's fees untimely under local rules?
No, Your Honor, it was not.
Why not?
The local rule, Rule 365, applies to briefing of pretrial motions. That is what it applies to. It actually, a copy of it is in the appendix to my brief in chief, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. What Judge Cooper told us, we followed Judge Cooper's procedure to the letter. He told us on February 25th, we were there for another motion. At the conclusion of that hearing, it's in the record, Your Honor, he said, we'll meet back here from May 13th for an evidentiary hearing on attorney's fees. We offered our bill at the hearing on the record at R-129. And he declined based upon attorney defense counsel's objection, appearing before the week before, on Thursday before, we delivered to defense counsel and to the court a memorandum on the issues and a copy of the brief and of the, excuse me, a copy of the bill for costs and attorney's fees. Those appear in the record, the memorandum and the invoice at R-103 and R-104, I believe. Your Honor. So the invoice was in. The costs were expressly set forth in the invoice. I'll save you the suspense. It was $41,000 in fees and about $11,000 in expenses. $10,700, I think, something like that, Your Honor. So the $15,000 award of undifferentiated, lumped together fees and costs paid $4,300, I believe, for the plaintiff's fees.
I got that out of your brief. I was really more concerned with whether you complied with the local rule or you did not comply with the local rule. And your statement is it does not apply to what was going on here.
It expressly does not apply.
Was there any order of the court to submit exhibits in advance of the hearing?
You know, that's the usual case, Justice Rogensack. Usually what the judge will do is, first of all, the two-day evidentiary hearing is very unusual. What most judges will say is 20 days before the hearing, the plaintiff will get any brief they have and any bill they have with an affidavits in, and then 10 days before, something like that, the defense will respond, we'll show up, we'll have an hour or 2 hours of argument, and then I'm going to make my decision. That's what most judges do. This judge made no order at all, and recites on the record that he made no order. He said, we'll come back here on May 13th, and we'll consider the issue. He left it open. We submitted our memorandum, as I've told you, the Thursday before, which coincidentally is the same day the defense counsel filed her memorandum on the issue. So the bill was filed with the court the week before. Now, there's something else I need to tell you, Justice Rogensack, which is that the bill was virtually unchanged from the previous November when we did the mediation. And at the mediation, as you recall, immediately after the mediation, there was an exchange of settlement offers by the parties. And the offer of attorney's fees in our statutory offer and the offer as to fees and costs in Wild's offer were based upon the very same invoice that Wild had in November 2001, 6 months before this hearing. So it is not a case where the counsel was taken by surprise by the invoice, and they didn't even argue that at the hearing. What Judge Cooper did, and this is in the record as well, he offered, and this is in the record at R-130, which is it was discussed at length in the motion for reconsideration. There was Chief Justice Abramson asked us, was there any discussion about a continuance or an adjournment if someone were taken by surprise. And in fact, there was no surprise for the very reason that we've just discussed, which is that the invoice was out there 6 months before at the time of the mediation. And so Judge Cooper's offer of a continuance, which I think it's Jinzaki versus Brookfield Ladder is the case, says generally if you're taken by surprise.
Well, you were the one that was taken by surprise, weren't you, because the evidence didn't get in?
Well, true. It is in the record, but you're right. He didn't consider it. What the Court of Appeals did with that was a little different. The Court of Appeals said, well, you know, the invoice was denied on the basis of this local rule governing briefing of pretrial motions, which is interesting. But they said it was a harmless error because the testimony still came in as to the amount of the fees, and the record itself reflects the amount of work done over the life of the case. Okay. And in fact, you know, there's something to that, I suppose. But no, we did testify, and there was 280 hours in there, $41,000 in fees and 10, some 11 in costs, Your Honor. And a large portion of that, of course, was for the mediation and for the discovery referee. And it's a little hard to understand what the trial judge was thinking in the undifferentiated award of $15,000. I agree with that. Because was he saying that the plaintiff doesn't get compensated for the filing fee, that plaintiff doesn't get compensated for the cost of the mediation when these are court ordered? You know, I doubt that he would say that. And yet there doesn't seem to be an award or an analysis of any costs that are reasonable. And the fees itself, the $4,300 that was awarded, there's one other thing I need to talk to you about, Justice Rogensack. You said $280 an hour.
Yeah, I thought that was the represented hourly rate.
The hourly rate was $145. It was much more modest. The $280 was the total hours
gotcha.
In the case.
Okay, thank you very much. That was nice of you to correct.
I wish I were paid at $280, and if...
Well, you know, some civil rights lawyers get right up there with that rate.
If you need some help at that rate.
Give you a call.
Thank you.
Counsel, you should conclude with
thank you,
sentence.
How long can I hold my breath? Your Honor, the brief of one of the amicus parties said basically there were a lot of factual disputes in this case, and that is correct. But when it came down to the bottom line, the facts were clear that a young woman got a car that had very severe problems under the guise of a dealership sale, and that the dealership and the manager involved, two managers that were involved in the case, committed some very serious improprieties. The case was contentious. There was no attempt to settle the case at any point for 2 years by the defense through two mediations, and for that reason, the bill was understandably high in relation to the amounts recovered under the circumstances. In the totality of the record, we ask that the decision of the Court of Appeals be remanded. This process, as illustrated in the reported decision on review, is broken. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to Mr. Erstfarmer, Mr. Meyer, Mr. Kunst, and Mr. Furlow for their arguments today in a case that not only affects these parties, but other people around the state. That concludes our hearing in 02-1915, Colifer versus Wild Pontiac Cadillac. And the court will be in recess for a few moments, so those students who wish to leave may, and the other students may enter the court. We are in recess for a few moments.